who will be presenting on mild cognitive impairment and dementia and neurodegenerative disorders. Dr. Sabah is a board-certified neurologist and geriatric neurologist who hopes to work himself out of a job. Considered one of the leading experts in Alzheimer's and dementia, Dr. Sabah has dedicated his entire career to finding a cure for Alzheimer's and other age-related neurodegenerative diseases. He is a leading investigator for many prominent national Alzheimer's prevention and treatment trials, including Alzheimer's immunotherapy studies, and he's on the editorial board for the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease and BMC Neurology. He is now editor-in-chief of Neurology and Therapy. He has authored and co-authored over 300 medical and scientific articles on Alzheimer's research. Dr. Sabah is the author of The Alzheimer's Answer, Reduce Your Risk and Keep Your Brain Healthy, with foreword by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and the Alzheimer's Prevention Cookbook, 100 Recipes to Boost Brain Health. He edited Palliative Care for Advanced Alzheimer's and Dementia Guidelines and Standards for Evidence-Based Care and Geriatric Neurology, published in 2014. He earned his undergraduate degree from the University of California, Berkeley, and his medical degree from the University of Arizona in Tucson. He received his residency training in neurology at Baylor College of Medicine, Houston, Texas, and completed his fellowship in geriatric neurology and dementia at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine, where he served on the faculty as assistant professor. And now, here is Dr. Sabah.
Hello, I'm Dr. Marwan Sabah. I am the Director of Translational Research here at the Cleveland Clinic Luruppo Center for Brain Health. Today I'm going to talk about mild cognitive impairment and dementia in the setting of neurodegenerative disorders. As you see here, dementia and all of the neurodegenerative diseases, including Alzheimer's particularly, are among the most common neurological diseases, as common as stroke. Alzheimer's disease is 2/3 of all dementias, which we'll talk about in more detail, but the point being is that these are very, very, very common conditions. The fundamental issue we're facing right now is that a timely diagnosis of Alzheimer's is an area of unmet need. Physicians just frankly don't feel comfortable making a diagnosis and will delay the diagnosis by 2 to 3 years after symptom onset, and some people never get diagnosed at all. I'll tell you this very specifically because I've seen patients come in the door, have had lots of MRIs, and have been seeing doctors for years, and they never get a diagnosis. It's conceptually, we're going to talk about a lot of new things here that you may or may not have heard of. But you understand that by the time they walk in the door in mild cognitive impairment or dementia, they've already had changes in the brain occurring up to 20 years before the onset of symptoms. So dementia effectively is the end of the disease. So we always talk about Alzheimer's disease because we are really referring to the dementia phase. But Alzheimer's disease conceptually is the preclinical phase, the mild cognitive impairment phase, and the dementia phase. And so I tell you this because in our context, the lexicon of Alzheimer's disease is the broad spectrum. When you are in practice, you're talking about Alzheimer's disease, and you're specifically only referring to the dementia phase. It's kind of like the advanced phase of cancer, metastatic cancer. So let's talk about new concepts. Concept number one is subjective memory complaint. Subjective memory complaint is what we say is a self-report of a memory issue. So a patient walks in the door and says, "Doctor, my memory is not what it used to be. I'm having problems with it. I'm misplacing keys and glasses, etc. I'm still getting along fine." The reason I tell you that is conceptually, you and I and others in the field had said, well, the fact that they're complaining about their memory makes them nervous, neurotic. We call them the worried well. There's actually now an ICD-10 code called R41.3. And we now know that subjective memory complaint is no longer something that should be dismissed or downplayed. Why am I saying this? Because they followed all those worried well people for decades, and they found that people often predicted the changes in their brain before the before the symptoms did. So here's a study suggesting that patients who went in Brazil, who for almost 250 patients who complained about their memory, that it had 100% sensitivity and 100% negative predictive value and was predictive. In fact, subjective memory complaint is a predictive of increased risk of progression, increased probability of having amyloid in their brain, It's associated with APOE4 carrier status, and there is evidence that there's pathology in the brain. So I'm telling you that a self-report of a memory complaint should no longer be dismissed as don't worry about it, but it should be evaluated, explored, and there's an ICD-10 code. Second concept is that mild cognitive impairment should be considered potentially as a prodrome of Alzheimer's disease dementia. So the construct of mild cognitive impairment first described first in 1999, then in 2001. And the construct was, in its classic definition, in the iteration was, a self-report of a memory complaint corroborated by an informant, objectively demonstrated without a functional impairment. Let me say that again. A self-report of a complaint corroborated by informant, objectively demonstrated, supported without any evidence of functional impairment. So a patient might complain, yeah, dad is not doing as well as he used to. He's still independent. He's still getting along. He's still driving and doing his finances, but he's, you know, now more forgetful than he used to be. He's still, you know, he's repeating himself. He's misplacing things, etc. So that would be the classic definition of mild cognitive impairment. In fact, the diagnostic criteria suggest that you have to have no evidence of functional impairment, but you would look out for neuropsychological testing, which I'll get in some detail here in the next few minutes. The patient would and the family would say there is a change from their pre-morbid condition that's affecting them now. And I will say to you that mild cognitive impairment is a really critical construct you need to know about, particularly if a monoclonal antibodies are approved, DMTs are approved, the focus of them will be mild cognitive impairment, and specifically the amnestic form of mild cognitive impairment, because amnestic form, meaning heavily anchored in memory, tends to be the prodrome of Alzheimer's disease dementia. And of course, historically, we've looked at this as an approach to exclude other pathologies. So in the clinical criteria, of course, if we could do this clinical dementia rating scale, CDR, it would be a 0.5 on this, that you have some mild memory changes on the MoCA or mini-mental. You have trouble on recall. So on MoCA, you might see a 0 out of 5 or 1 out of 5 on the recall. And you would have, and generally, no other etiology can be identified. The reason we talk about it, and the first thing I want you to know is that I actually, when I see a patient with mild cognitive impairment, where I suspect to be mild cognitive impairment, I send them for neuropsychological tests. And I tell my neuropsychologist, is this amnestic or non-amnestic? So if you look at this slide here, you see on the left-hand side that the patients with amnestic forms, meaning a single or multi-domain MCI, have Alzheimer's prodrome 99 times out of 100. And if it's non-amnestic forms, it's only a sensitive for progression to Alzheimer's disease about 50% of the time. So we talk about progression as preclinical, mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's pathology, and Alzheimer's dementia. Who is at risk? So standard way, of course, we would do is we do a good history and physical. You would do neuropsychological assessment, might do MRI, APOE genotyping is controversial. But it's important this audience understands that we can now predict who is going to convert. So a patient comes in the door. You say, determine that they have mild cognitive impairment. You send them for neuropsychological testing, and you are asked, and the neuropsychological testing says there's amnestic forms of mild cognitive impairment. We can now predict. There are four things that predict that they're going to progress to dementia and progress to dementia fairly soon. Number one is that the hippocampus, the small hippocampus. So if you do volumetric MRI with the NeuroQuant software and understand that there'll be multiple companies coming out. NeuroQuant's just the first, but there's about two or three more coming right behind that. A small hippocampus with evidence of neurodegeneration suggests that if you have the hippocampal volume is the fifth percentile or below, you have evidence of neurodegeneration, and you may have the prodrome of Alzheimer's disease. Second is if you've bottomed out on your neuropsychological memory scores, that is a predictor of progression. Third is the evidence of APOE positivity. So we know that APOE4 carriers have a progression rate of 17% per year to dementia, and if a non-E4 carrier, it's only 6%. percent per year. And the fourth thing is evidence of amyloid either by CSF testing or by amyloid PIB, Pittsburgh compound B. So if you're low CSF and amyloid and high tau and you have mild cognitive impairment, you will 90% of them progress to dementia in 1 year. So we do know amyloid positivity, APOE4 positivity, CSF, hippocampal volume below the fifth percentile, and poor memory scores are all predictive of mild cognitive impairment to dementia. How good is the data? Here's some of the data on PIB-PET, suggesting that if you are PIB positive in just 12 months, one out of three people will progress to dementia. And if you're PIB negative, only one out of six will progress to dementia in a year. Here's another study out of Australia suggesting that if you're PIB negative, only one out of 13 progress in almost 2 years. And if you're PIB positive, four out of five progress in just under 2 years. And similar things you see with on the Pittsburgh cohort. So what I'm trying to tell you is that we can predict. The construct of mild cognitive impairment is real. It's important that you understand it. There's a clinical and classical definition of it. There's a neuropsychological definition of it. And it can be predictive of progression to dementia. And I gave you the four predictors. So I've kind of summarized this. Now let's move on to dementia. The differentiation between dementia and mild cognitive impairment is simply the presence or absence of functional impairment tied to the cognitive impairment. So what do I mean? You know, functional impairment in a stroke is easy because they have physical disability, but in a dementia state, sometimes it's very subtle. Last year, I did my taxes. This year, I don't do my taxes. I used to be able to manage my checkbook. Now I'm having trouble. I'm paying the bills twice. I'm forgetting to pay the bills. That's a good example. Used to be able to manage all my medications. Now I can't figure out which pill box to use and which to put them in and orders like that. Things like that. So what I'm trying to say is that when the cognitive impairment starts to cause functional impairment, it can be very subtle. That's when we move them from mild cognitive impairment to dementia. So I want to talk first about dementia. So 1980, the DSM-4 criteria of dementia starts with the NINDS-ADRDA criteria, which says you have to have two areas of cognition impaired with functional impairment. That was put forth, it's been recast in 2011, and that seems to hold up as a construct. So the dementia as a construct holds up very well. In DSM-5, we understand that we only need one area of cognition affected, and we would call it major neurocognitive disorder. We'll talk about Alzheimer's disease here in a second. I do want to say that the difference is to have Alzheimer's disease dementia, you must have dementia first, and then you have to, biomarker evidence is considered to be advisory but not essential. So the classic definition is dementia, insidious onset, amnestic versus non-amnestic forms. Remember that dementia is the category of disease, and we'll kind of spend the rest of the time talking about the category of disease. So the category of disease is very important because dementia can be caused by Lewy body, vascular. In fact, like I said, the rest of this lecture will be spent talking about dementia beyond Alzheimer's dementia. But the definition of Alzheimer's dementia is a classic amnestic presentation with a biomarker evidence of contribution. I will tell you that if you look at the phenotype of Alzheimer's disease, you as an audience member typically think of it as the amnestic form. But in fact, if you look at it from a phenotypic standpoint, there are three subforms of Alzheimer's disease, meaning the amnestic form is the most classic one, but the language one, logopenic PPA, primary progressive aphasia, and the PCA, posterior cortical atrophy, are all visual variant, language variant, and amnestic variant are all phenotypes or presentations of Alzheimer's disease. The reason I say this to you is that we still typically will take a B12, TSH, and MRI as our diagnosis of exclusion approach. That just is no longer going to hold up as we move on. But the point being is that the historical approach is a diagnosis of exclusion, and now we're moving to a diagnosis of inclusion. So we have two working groups, the NIAAA working group, which says that biomarker evidence is considered advisory but not essential, versus the IWG working group, International Working Group, which suggests that amnestic form, clinical progression, lasting more than 6 months, plus any evidence of positivity on biomarker, CSF, PET, genetics, et cetera, equals a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And so this is very important. Fast forward to 2018, and you have, of course, the ATN criteria. ATN criteria, A stands for amyloid, T stands for tau, and N stands for neurodegeneration. And the reason I say this to you is that if you have no amyloid in your brain, you may have dementia, but you don't have Alzheimer's dementia. So Alzheimer's disease is considered to be an amyloidopathy. And of course, we would love to confirm by tauopathy and neurodegeneration. So the middle of the slide, you see A positive, N positive, T positive, amyloid positive, tau positive, and neurodegeneration positive. The middle three, the numbers 2 through 5 are, in fact, evidence of amyloidopathies and therefore are Alzheimer's disease specific. But if you're amyloid negative, you can have other dementias but not have Alzheimer's disease. So it's very important that you understand the concept of ATN, because there's a movement right now to try to incorporate ATN into a clinical paradigm. So I want to talk about the fact that Alzheimer's disease dementia has a very ordinal progression of decline. We lose independent of activities of daily, instrumental activities of daily living, followed by activities of daily living, followed by continence, followed by end-of-life palliative perspectives. And it's very predictive. I'm a very frequent user of an instrument called the FAST, the Functional Assessment Staging Scale. And I know that that has the ordinal progression of decline embedded in it. A FAST of 4 means you're having trouble with checks and bills and finances, et cetera, et cetera. That's a FAST of 4. A FAST of 5 means that you're repeating, you're having trouble dressing yourself. A FAST of 6 through is having problems with bathing, setting the hot and cold in the shower, incontinence, et cetera. So let's talk about the differential diagnosis of dementia. So dementia, as I said, is a category of disease, much like cancer is a category of disease. Alzheimer's disease is the most common type of dementia after constituting 2/3 of all dementia, but there are other kinds of dementia, including Lewy body dementia, which we'll spend a minute talking about. Vascular dementia, frontotemporal dementia, Parkinson's disease can cause dementia. Alcohol, and normal pressure hydrocephalus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what I'm saying to you is that the category is broad for for dementia, but Alzheimer's is a specific type of dementia, but not the only type of dementia. And what we've found from recent pathological studies from Rush University and other centers have shown clearly that when you look at the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease, many of them have overlap. They could have plaques and tangles and Lewy bodies or vascular changes or TDP-43 or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm saying to you that pure Alzheimer's disease with just plaques and tangles and nothing else is only a third of brains and that the most of them are overlap. So let's talk about Lewy body dementia, and you will understand now there's the latest iteration of Lewy body dementia has the classic definition of fluctuations, meaning that you get better and worse throughout the day or throughout day to day, visual, striking, well-formed visual hallucinations, Parkinsonism, and dream enactment behavior. Those are the four things that you see as core criteria. And I will say to you that these patients are very, very unpredictable. In fact, what you see is that these patients are much more difficult to manage than the typical Alzheimer patient. Whereas consider Alzheimer's disease dementia to be very predictable, Lewy body dementia is not. So the other thing you need to know about Lewy body dementia is much more common than people think. And so if you figure that Alzheimer's disease is 5 million people, there's about 8 million people in America with dementia. So 5 million of them or so, 5.5 million have Alzheimer's disease dementia. 1 million have Lewy body dementia. It's the second most common type of dementia. It's the one that nobody's ever heard of, but it's very common. Remember, this is one that Robin Williams had. There's a rumor that Ted Turner had it. There's other famous people having it. So Lewy body dementia is very, very unfortunate and is unpredictable and difficult to manage, I must say. Third, is vascular dementia. So the reason this is very important is that vascular dementia is considered to be third in the United States, but some places might be the second most common form of dementia. This is very important. This audience understand it is if you have a little white matter change around your brain, that does not give you vascular dementia. You have to have a lot of white matter or strokes in particular areas like the thalamus or the medial temporal lobe to call it vascular dementia. And you should have a stepwise decline. You should have a multifocal distribution of decline. You should have focality on the exam, et cetera. So I'm saying to you is that vascular dementia is a common construct. The next is frontotemporal dementias. And we now separate the frontotemporal dementias into two subforms, the LVs and the BVs. The BV is behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia. And that's the one you see here is the classic one of the impairment, the judgment, the lack of insight, et cetera. We now know there are multiple mutations associated with them or genetics, including TDP43, progranulin, FUS, and others. And so the reason you understand this is that we now understand that most of the FTDs, including C9 or F72, have markers, genetic markers to identify them. So behavioral variant is the classic variant of FTD, but this other variant is LV-FTD or language variant. We also call the LV-FTD the progressive aphasias, and there are three subtypes, the PNFA, progressive non-fluent aphasia, semantic dementia, and logopenic primary progressive aphasia. Let me spend a minute talking about logopenic primary progressive first. The logopenic variant is associated with Alzheimer pathology, whereas semantic dementia and PNFA are associated with the FTD pathology. Some may have tau, and like I said, progranulin, FUS, TDP43, etc. So it's very important you understand that they are very different. PNFA looks like a progressive non-fluent aphasia. It looks like they have a Broca's aphasia, very aphasic, very dense aphasia. Semantic dementia means that they have loss of the understanding and meaning of words, and they just don't understand you when you talk to them. Those tend to be TDP43-opathies. So it's understand these are the LV-FTDs as opposed to the BV-FTDs. So we would break them into neurodegenerative category. This is unfortunately 90% of the dementias. And then the 10% are the is the amenable to treatment. I haven't seen neurosyphilis, tertiary syphilis in, I think maybe in the entirety of my career, I've seen one. I've seen more mad cow or Creutzfeldt-Jakob than I've seen neurosyphilis. I will say to you, actually make that two. They're that memorable and that rare. I've seen three brain tumors present as dementia, mostly in the midline falcine, perifalcine. We tend to call pseudo-dementia from depression, but in fact, depression is now identified as a presenting feature of and an antecedent symptom of dementia. So you could say that they have pseudo-dementia and you treat their depression, all of a sudden their mood is better, but their memory is not. So be careful with the construct of pseudo-dementia. First thing, of course, I would always do is I do a very thorough physical neurological exam, and I look at their gait. If I can do anything, I look at their gait. So why? Because we've seen patients, and I saw one just this week with a suspicion for normal pressure hydrocephalus. And I understand that these are extreme examples of the one on the left is the classic normal pressure hydrocephalus, but that's an extreme version of this. This is a downloaded right off of Google Images, and right is a normal brain. And the classic amnestic form, the classic form, of course, has the triad, as you know it, as incontinence, gait, and magnetic gait, and memory impairment. And you understand this very important, that if you're descending patient for shunting, if they will get better, their gait will get better, 75%. Continence will get better, 50%. But memory, if you're only shunting them for memory, the yield is very, very low. So I would tell you that be careful when you send patients for shunting. The other thing you need to know, of course, is that if they don't get better from their lumbar puncture, they're not going to get better from their shunt. So it's important that you do the gait analysis. We send patients for a gait lab. We watch their walking. We measure their stride. And the other thing we do, of course, is look at their pre and post LP gait. There's another thing you can do is a sternogram, and as you see in panel D, if the tracer is concentrating in the brain, that would be a positive for normal pressure hydrocephalus. The other thing we look for is Parkinsonism, so and other things. So if you see myoclonus or jerking, that think about CJD. If you see chorea, of course, you think about Huntington's disease. Parkinson's disease is very similar to Lewy body dementia pathologically. The difference is that Parkinson's disease has their Parkinson's symptoms for a decade or more before they develop dementia. And the latest data suggests that up to 70% of people with Parkinson's disease will eventually develop dementia. Whereas Lewy body dementia tends to get their Parkinsonism and cognitive decline within a year or two of each other. So the differentiator really is chronicity more than it is pathology. This is the examination we want to do. And we have always taken the idea that this is a diagnosis of exclusion. I want to challenge you, and here's why I want to challenge you. There's a study we did suggesting that if patients we called Alzheimer's disease dementia had Alzheimer pathology in their brain 3 out of 4 times and did not have Alzheimer pathology in their brain 1 out of 4 times. So we know that a clinical diagnosis is not that accurate, and that's a very important thing. And what I'm telling you, of course, is that we're seeing use, we do not see routine use of CSF testing or PET imaging, one, because of invasiveness, and two, because of bio expense and not covered by Medicare. So what I'm saying is that these are available, but they're not routinely used. One thing we do use a lot of course, is MRI. And MRI suggests that it has good spec and sense, so it can differentiate normals, particularly with the neurodegeneration, from Alzheimer's dementia. But it doesn't differentiate vascular very well from Lewy body, from FTD. We think we can do well on that, but in fact, the objective data suggests that it is not the case. I'm a big fan of genotyping my patients, but I strongly sit in the minority of people. It is not routine practice to do APOE genotyping, but understand that PET scan in the setting of a clinical dementia is very accurate, but very expensive, to the tune of $3,000 to $5,000. However, APOE genotyping is cheap, and it's a proxy test of amyloid positivity. So if you're an APOE4 carrier in a symptomatic state, meaning you're having memory impairment, the probability of amyloid pathology in your brain is exceeding 90%. And if you're non-carrier, it's only 60 to 70%. So it is predictive of amyloid positivity. I will say to you, when you talk about biomarkers and how I talked about it before, understand if you actually use IWG and carry it forward. So if you're biomarker positive in the red left panel, red line, the probability of progression is 90% in 5 years. And if you look at the right panel, probably with the pathology, progression is overwhelmingly high. And if you don't have amyloid, if you don't use biomarker evidence and you don't do it, you can see that the rate of progression is very low. Now, we would love, love, love to do amyloid PET. Amyloid PET is approved since 2013. Fluorobeta-PIR, fluorobeta-BANE 2014, flutamatamol in 2015. The fundamental issue is that they are binary. So positive, negative, you have amyloid pathology in your brain or you don't, but does not correlate with clinical progression and is not covered by Medicare. So where most recently, though, tau PET has been approved, and is fluortausapir, is the name of it. But you need to know, of course, that it correlates very, very well with clinical progression, but is not covered by Medicare. So how do we move to a diagnosis of exclusion to a diagnosis of inclusion? So let's talk about biomarkers. So I know I'm running out of time. Biomarker evidence would be considered to be important, and we look at biomarkers in three specific categories. One is positive-negative, meaning you have pathology or don't. Two is a marker of progression, and three is a marker of response to clinical treatment. And so that would be considered a theragnostic marker. So, of course, I've already talked about PET. Let's talk about CSF. In CSF, in practice now, we've moved away from the Athena Diagnostics to the Roche Alexis platform, and it measures amyloid, tau, phosphorylated tau, and the A-beta 42 to tau ratio, and it is very, very good specificity and sensitivity. And if you actually look at the spec and sense, it has been highly validated, hundreds of studies, tens of thousands of patients, and the spec and sense is absolutely really strong. So CSF testing is very good. It's now becoming cheaper and very accurate. So, and you can get a result now in about 3 to 5 days. So I want to talk about the fact that there's now lots and lots of evidence. The CSF testing is predictive of conversion. So if you have a CSF profile consistent with Alzheimer's disease, the progression to dementia is over 90% in a year. And the more important thing, and this is the one that you need to understand, is that CSF correlates very, very well with amyloid PET. So CSF is going to give you three markers. Amyloid PET is going to give you one. CSF is invasive but cheaper, efficient. Amyloid PET is expensive, not covered by Medicare. And so CSF correlates very, very well. The one thing you do need to know about is the presence of this new blood test, plasma A-beta-42, just approved by CLIA certification about 4 months ago. And it is the first plasma diagnostic tool for Alzheimer's detection. It's really very exciting change. This is a major breakthrough in our field. If I can say it's the one big change in since I gave a talk to this conference last year, is the presence now and the approval and the availability of the C2N blood diagnostic. I want to tell you that it is not covered by Medicare. So let's talk about the journey, how we're going to change it. And what I'm saying to you is now we would use informant-based questionnaires, risk analyses, bedside testing, physical neuro, blood tests for genetic assays, for the amyloid tau index or the plasma A-beta-42 to 40, and then you would apply international working group. How is this going to be applied? I think what's going to happen in the future is that a patient will come in and identify themselves. When they schedule their appointment, they will either see a PCP who will refer them, and when they're referred, maybe the physician has done the plasma amyloid or not. Maybe they get the cognitive testing before their visit, log into a portal like we're doing now with something like MyChart, do some bedside cognitive testing. That report's available to the physician by the time they walk in the door, and then can be flagged or not flagged for further testing or evaluation. Then you would include the MRI, the imaging, the blood tests, the CSF potential, et cetera. So in other words, you're moving to not just define the clinical phenotype, but if they have biomarker evidence of inclusivity as you get them ready for a new treatment. So in conclusion, the identification of mild cognitive impairment can be made with more confidence. We can use it as a predictive progression with greater accuracy. It is no longer a diagnosis of exclusion, and the technology is available to greatly improve the diagnostic accuracy of Alzheimer's disease. Thank you very much.
Welcome back, and thank you, Dr. Sabah, for that very, very detailed presentation. Very good. Dr. Sabah is traveling today, but we do have him on the phone, and I'm happy about that because you are just the man to answer this next question. Biogen monoclonal antibody was just approved. Expert panel all voted no. Would you use it?
So, Eliana, it's a question I've been asked a lot this week. Did a lot of interviews for the press. First is that often override the external advisors about 22% of the time. This is one of the 22% time. Second, the internal FDA advisors, meaning scientists within the FDA, voted to approve it. So they had two sets of opinions that they had to balance between one being the internal advisors and two, these external advisors. To speak more directly to my practice, I am pro-treatment. I have to say to you that having seen patients, thousands of patients with mild cognitive impairment, who all look with the face of panic that they see their impending decline into dementia, I'm looking for every and all opportunities to treat them. If you actually break the data down very carefully, we know that the people with mild cognitive impairment who are amyloid positive, who get the highest dose, 10 milligrams per kilogram, are very likely to get a benefit of a 22% slowing in the rate of decline as measured by the Clinical Dementia Rating Scale, or CDR, sum of the boxes. So this is a very significant effect, and this is an effect that's going to grow over time. So my point is that the answer to the question is yes, I am going to use it. I also know that this is the first of potentially many treatments. And so is aducanumab going to be the last thing we use? Probably not, but it is the first and important first step. I would remind this audience that atorvastatin and Lipitor and Crestor were the seventh and eighth statins used, not Pravacol, Bavecol, and Mevacor. So the point is that each treatment gets better and better, and so this is an important first step. And the answer to the question is yes.
Okay, thank you. The next question is, can you comment on the basic neuroscience studies showing that glutamate increases amyloid toxicity? Does this suggest that future anti-glutamate therapies may have efficacy?
Yeah, so that's kind of a circular argument. We know that amyloid causes... damages neurons and other receptors. And so my point is that we know that glutamate is that glutamate is important. The curious question that is part of that is that if that was the case, then anti-glutamate treatments like NMDA antagonists should have affected amyloid a la Namenda. And we, as far as we know, there's no evidence that NMDA antagonists like Namenda have affected amyloid. So in theory, the answer is yes, but in practice, we're not sure that we can prove that question.
Okay, you have another question here. Does Medicare pay for cerebral spinal fluid diagnostics?
So this is a great and important question. Historically, it was a challenge to get them to pay for the Athena test. But in the last 3 months, Athena Diagnostics has pretty much abandoned their CSF testing, and now Roche Diagnostics with their Elecsys platform does the testing through Mayo Clinic, and it is covered by Medicare. And it will probably become the preferred way to get a diagnosis since amyloid PET is still not covered, and the plasma amyloid test is not clearly determined to be effective, or I should say, useful yet.
Okay, Dr. Sabah, that's all the questions we have right now. Thank you so much for tuning in and sharing your expertise.
Thank you.
Thank you.